tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. You are listening to part 41. Yes, 41 weeks in a row of The International Jew by Henry Ford. I am your host, Ted Midward, and you are listening to RadioAryan.com. The first half of today's episode starts with an article entitled, A Jew Sees His People as Others See Them. This week we present another Jew's comment on his race and for the good of the race. Bert Levy has said these things before Jewish women's councils and B'nai B'rith lodges, and they will assist readers of this series to an understanding of some of the truer, though minority, influences which are at work in American Jewry. He sincerely exposes every obvious defect, and it is to be hoped that one day, with as sincere a pen, he will go deeper. Mr. Levy's chosen title is this, For the Good of the Race. From a far-off land I came, a sad-eyed, pale-faced, poetic young Jew, with an unspeakable love of my people burning in my heart. Of Polish-Russian heritage, there was implanted in my nature an indefinable sorrow, born perhaps of my father's and mother's persecution, that left me high-strung and sensitive to the anti-Semitic taunts of my schoolmates. Given to idle dreaming by some old abandoned shaft or roaming the deserted alluvial diggings of the little mining town of my youth, I would conjure up visions of the new world I had so often read about, that great country where there was no prejudice against my race, the New Jerusalem. Shyly hugging to my breast some borrowed American book or magazine, I would seek the shadows of the huge decaying poppet legs and dream over the pages containing many Jewish faces, and read with pride and gratitude of the high places occupied by my people in music, art, literature, and drama. Filled with Jewish names and good Jewish deeds was the story of this new Zion, and a longing to be among the great ones of my people took possession of me. Between my dear father and myself, there was a bond of love too sacred for words, and when I looked upon his dear face for the last time in this world, and bade him a sorrowful goodbye before my departure for the New Jerusalem, he held me close to his breast and whispered, "Don't forget that you are a Jew, and if you need sympathy, love, or help, go to your own race and show your Arba Kanfoth." Author's note here, according to Deuteronomy 22:12, the Jews are commanded to wear fringe upon four corners of their vestures, and this command is observed to the present day by wearing a special garment with these fringes and generally hidden by the ordinary clothes. I carried my father's words across the ocean in my heart, and the memory of his tear-dimmed eyes and the pressure of his big loving arms has never left me. In fact, it is so strong at times that I find it hard to believe that he is not by my side telling me, in spite of many disappointments, that after all the Jews are still my brethren and sisters. Words fail to describe my feelings as the beauties of the new world unfolded to me, in wonderful contrast to the melancholy aspect of my own country was the joyous color of Samoa, with its hallowed memories of Robert Louis Stevenson, lifted like some fairy veil out of the mist of the Pacific to give me a glimpse, as it were, of my dream of America, the New Jerusalem. Oh, the wonderful days and wonderful nights out on that vast blue expanse, where God and his stars seemed so near that one formed a good resolution with every throb of the great engine far down below. On one of those nights, I sat listening to someone playing in the music salon, and I was inwardly thanking the Creator that there was a Puccini in the world, and that he had given us La Boheme. There we were, thousands of miles from anywhere, languidly rolling under a perfect moonlit sky, listening to the plaintive airs that Puccini had coined for Mimi. There was hardly a sound but the gentle lapping of the waves breaking against the vessel's side, till a slight commotion on deck up ahead caused some of the listeners to investigate. One of the passengers, an ex-Harvard man, returned with the remark, "Oh, it's only some damned Jew. He's fallen and hurt himself pretty badly." Like a smudge on some beautiful picture was this anti-Semitic sentiment on such a night, and considering its source, I felt deeply grieved. As I was the only other Jew in the first cabin, I made my way to the stateroom where they had carried the victim of the accident and found him to be a tender-hearted old man who I subsequently learned had spent a long life in acts of charity toward his fellow men and women, regardless of creed. He was returning to end his days in Jerusalem. His Jerusalem, not the one of my dreams, where he could touch again the beloved stones of the Wailing Wall. Something in the old man's face, that something which was in the face of my father, my brother, that something which is in the face of every Jew, drew me to him, as it has drawn me to all Jews always, and I spend many intellectual hours by his bedside, picking up grains of wisdom which he had translated from the Talmud. I wished that the ex-Harvard man could have known that the old man's wrinkles were but the pathetic records of the massacres of his kith and kin which he had witnessed in his homeland, and that he daily prayed for death to efface the awful memories. Later on, the ex-Harvard man asked me to join him in a deck game. I reminded him that I also was a damned Jew. "I'm sorry," he said. "I know what you refer to. That was an unfortunate slip I made the other night. Merely a figure of speech, I assure you." I found him a charming companion, and soon, in a cozy corner of the smoking room, we became fast friends, and I tried to win him over to think better of our people. "I would like to hear your opinion of your fellow Jew after you've spent, say, 12 months in America," he said. Since then, I have walked the length and breadth of the great cities of America, and my very soul cried out to my fellow Jews, "Suppress thyself!" The day I arrived in New York, I learned that my dearest friend, my father, had passed away, and naturally my first thought was to say the Kaddish, a prayer of the Jewish liturgy, recited by orphans for the welfare of the souls of their deceased parents, somewhat after the fashion of the Catholic Mass. Every male of Jewish blood at some time of his life recites this beautiful prayer. It does not matter how far one strays from the fold or how much one has denied the faith. There comes a time when the Jew in him asserts itself and he says the Kaddish. Public prayer among Jews can be recited only in the presence of 10 males above the age of religious maturity, and this assembly is called Minyan. Surely in this great city I would easily find a Minyan, I thought. So I followed the line of least resistance, like any stranger in a strange land, and sought out the Jewish names best known to the public. I called a business house uptown with the name of a great Hebrew over the door. He was the great man of whom I had read with such pride in the little mining town at the under end of the world. Yes, the same Jewish face depicted in the huge photograph in the lobby I had seen in the magazine I had hugged so lovingly at home. I made my way, full of hope, to his office and was asked by a doorkeeper my mission. I explained, the doorkeeper was a Hebrew, that I desired to say Kiddush for my father, and that I wanted to form a minyan. With a sly wink, he passed me on to several Hebrew clerks and office boys, each of whom smiled, sneered, and made his little joke about greenhorns. Then I was ushered with many grimaces into the presence of the big man. Just a minute's conversation convinced me that he was a Jew in appearance only, and that he had never known anything of the traditions, the romance, the art, or the literature of our race. He didn't exactly know what minyan was, or pretended he didn't, but recommended me to one of our people, as he put it, who ran a very popular chop house close by. I began to realize that I was a stranger among my own people, and that night I walked the streets of the great New York with an aching heart. Everywhere in the hurrying crowds, I saw the faces of my brethren and sisters, thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, hurrying, pushing, shoving brethren they were, with all the tenderness, the friendship, and the Semitic look gone from their eyes. Oh God, I thought. Are these the children of Israel? Is this the persecuted race? That people who had been scattered to the four corners of the earth? Hungry and weary, I made my way, as if in a dream, to the cafe of a great hotel. Everything in the huge room was glaringly false. Marble pillars, oak beams, flowers, were all imitation. A big orchestra sat in a balcony with an artificial moon and a painted sky as a background. Everywhere were lights, lights, and more lights. From table to table I went, but I was roughly reminded that this was reserved, and that was reserved. Presently glaring, gowned, bediamonded Jewish women, accompanied by equally vulgar Jewish men, filed in and occupied every seat. In between mouthfuls of food and drink, their bodies would sway to the voices of other Jews who sang only of Mississippi and Georgia. How these people did laugh when they caught sight of my foreign clothes and my pale, poetic face, and how they would have screamed with laughter had I shown them my Arba Kanfoth, that beautiful little token which my poor father fondly imagined would have made me understood in the New World. Out in the night I went, and found myself struggling in a torrent of humanity. Every time I received an extra bump or hard push, I looked only to see that my antagonist was a Hebrew. On the street, in the cars, in the subway, or at the soda fountain, wherever I saw my fellow Jews blatantly shouting and rudely pushing, I, in spite of my indignation, felt the love of my race uppermost in my heart, and I wanted to cry out, O Jew, dear brothers and sisters, suppress yourselves for the good of the race. Stand back for the good of the race. Never in the world have our people known such a free country as this, and it is a privilege to be here, but at times a great fear comes over me that we are abusing that privilege. Amid the din of Jewish music and laughter, the newsboys are shouting the names of Jewish murderers, i.e. the Rosenthal case, the gunmen of the city. The bribe givers and the bribe takers depicted in the news sheets have Jewish countenances. The gambling housekeepers, yes, yes. I know that there are Christians who are murderers, gamblers, and informers, but the Jew is a marked man. He is distinct, apart, so distinct that in a crowd he is the first noticed. It is for this reason that I would have my brethren and sisters suppress themselves, stand back. I would have real Jews take the worst of a bargain once in a while for the sake of the race. I would have them once in a while give up their seats in public conveyances, behave modestly in cafes, dress quietly, and give up the use of assumed Christian names. There is nothing so pathetic as the man who, with Hebrew face, assumes a Christian name. I never go to a public place without wishing that my fellow Jew would talk less and appear less ostentatious. When one Hebrew comes in late to a show, marches down the aisle, and on the front row deliberately obstructs the view of people in the audience as he stands slowly removing and folding his coat and gloves, he seems to cause more annoyance than if a half a dozen Gentiles did the same thing. When a Jew stands aside and waits patiently at a ticket window, gives his seat to a lady on the streetcar, or behaves in a refined manner in any walk of life, he immediately makes friends for our people. Most of our people, I have found, have aggressive personalities. It is the aggressiveness which has enabled many immigrants to pass through Ellis Island to ownership of fine apartment houses all within a couple of years. But sometimes this aggressiveness becomes absolutely cruel, crushing from the very soul all the tender elements which go to make up a happy life. Recently I thought with much bitterness of my father's last words to me. If you need sympathy, love, or help, go to your own race. Ill health came over me and I became involved in debt for a trifling amount. Each stage of my embarrassment and consequent suffering was contributed by a brother Jew. First, the shyster lawyer, without principle or mercy, then his brutal clerks, sly and grafting, next a collector, absolutely callous, then the process server, and, at last, the bouncer, sans heart, sans soul, sans everything. If all these agents of misfortune were Gentiles, I could have borne it. But the greatest heartbreak of all was the fact that one and all of them were brother Jews. Why must a Jew always be in at the death, as it were? There came a time soon after this when I walked the streets almost penniless. Seeking work, I applied at the store of a wealthy Hebrew. I explained to the well-groomed proprietor that I was an Orthodox member of his race and appealed on that ground for a chance. He pooh-poohed the idea. "My dear fellow," he said, "these are the enlightened days when Judaism is not taken seriously. In fact, it doesn't pay. I am a Christian cultist. I meet nice people, and it helps my business." Here was a poor fool with his head like the ostrich's in the sand. I explained to him that being a Jew was not a question of religion, but a question of blood. I told him that if a Jewish leopard ceased visiting the synagogue to go to a Christian cultist chapel, it did not necessarily get rid of its spots. I left him scratching his head, and I also lost the chance of a job in his store. In and out of offices, presided over by men with Jewish faces, I trudged all day. Most of these men, I subsequently learned, belonged to the New Thought Christian cultists and other up-to-date churches and societies. It was good for their business. They called themselves Christians, but nature's marks cannot be changed like one's clothes. In the great theatrical districts, I found thousands of my fellow Jews who had grown rich overnight by coining perhaps a popular song that had pleased the cabaret mad crowd, or by ridiculous impersonations of their race upon the music hall stages. A good many of these were young men, sons of fathers and mothers, who had been driven from their own country with fire and sword. The mothers and fathers stay at home blessing God every hour of the day and night for guiding them to such a country as this, while the sons and daughters are out at the theaters, in the halls, and cabarets singing songs of Dixie. Passing by in this great throng are prominent actors, critics, and playwrights, many under assumed names, simply because their own names are Jewish. Flashing across the horizon as I write is a notorious Jewish doctor with a consumption cure. He could have been famous and honored had he but suppressed himself, instead of which he, with his commercial instinct and his press agent methods, made more enemies for the race. Many Gentiles, I will admit, have had consumption cures, but it remained for one of our people to float companies and open institutions before the cure was even reported upon by the government. Tramping the city, tired and weary of looking for friendly Jewish faces, I found myself near the city hall. I approached a milk station and bought a cent's worth of the most delicious milk I've ever tasted. A rough-looking fellow next to me said as he smacked his lips, "Pretty good stuff, that." And perhaps noting that I was a stranger, he added, "The guy who is doing this milk thing is saving the babies, all right. He's some rich Jew. God bless him. I've got 3 babies of my own." Hungering to hear a Jew praised, I talked with this man for an hour, listening with keen enjoyment to the story of one of my race who had caused his millions to do good for the people irrespective of creed, and had kept himself suppressed. I learned of this Jew's efforts for the dying babies at home, and for his starving co-religionists in Palestine, and felt proud. Proud and happy for the first time, I sat in the little park watching the passing procession till I dozed off into a sound sleep. My happiness continued in my sleep, for I have a most beautiful dream. Before me in my dream passed a grand parade. It was a series of "For the Good of the Race" stories. All the prominent professional Jews headed the procession with their real names and the names of their race emblazoned upon silk banners in letters of gold. Then came all the Hebrew gambling house keepers bearing aloft broken roulette wheels and other emblems of a discarded and disgraced business. Next in order was a large army of Hebrews who were professional bondsmen for arrested streetwalkers, headed by 2 crooked ward politicians carrying a streamer with the words, "Henceforth, we will go to work." These men looked a little sad as they marched along thinking of the easy money they were leaving behind. But the cheers of the multitude exulting over their great sacrifice somewhat atoned for their agony of mind. Next followed the Amalgamated Jewish Usurers, Real Estate and Company Promoters Union. This part of the parade took 4.5 hours to pass a given point. All the marchers had discarded their expensive clothing and their diamonds and were modestly attired. They had also discarded their automobiles. Many of the prominent men in this section carried flags and banners upon which were inscribed the legends, "We will not lie about values. We will not charge exorbitant interest. And we will not water our stock." These inscriptions were received with incredulous looks of astonishment, and many of the crowd called out, "We're from Missouri," whatever that meant. Then came a beautiful torchlight brigade called the Hebrew Firebugs Union. Nearly all these men had their hair close cropped and wore prison clothes, a fact which filled the crowd with relief. Next came that part of the procession which showed the greatest following among its marchers. It was the large army of Hebrew aggressives. Hundreds and thousands of them passed by with reformed looks upon their faces. Oh, I felt so happy as I read the buttons they wore and saw the flags they carried. Most of the streamers read, "We will suppress ourselves. We will stand back and keep quiet. We will be unostentatious." There they were, hundreds of well-known faces and types. End-seat hogs, front-seat hogs, loud talkers, inconsiderates, bargainers, and the terrible army of people that go to make up the crowd which is directly responsible for the anti-Semitic feeling. The line of them was miles long. I was awakened from my happy dream by a rude thump from a Jewish policeman who hurried me to the police station, where I was surrounded by shyster lawyers, my brethren, who wanted money with which they could square other brethren. I could not gain the services of a Hebrew bondsman because I had no pull. A Hebrew magistrate called me a bum and a loafer for going to sleep in a public park. "Keep awake in the future," he said as I was roughly bundled out of the court. "Keep awake." This is the worst advice he could have given me, for I was so happy asleep and dreaming that my brethren and sisters had reformed and had become real Jews for the sake of the race. I now look upon my police court humiliation as the best thing that could have happened to me. Keep awake. This is the worst advice he could have given me, for I was so happy asleep and dreaming that my brethren and sisters had reformed and had become real Jews for the sake of the race. I now look upon my police court humiliation as the best thing that could have happened to me, for a kindly old Jewish scholar who acted as court interpreter was attracted by my appearance. His long contact with human misery and his great experience with foreigners stranded in a strange country enabled him to understand me. That night, he took me to his poverty-stricken little room behind a delicatessen shop in the ghetto. After supper, he went to the street door and called the neighbors from their stoops. He called them by their first names, and I said Kaddish for my father as they stood around among the pickle barrels. Since then, I have lived among Jews, real Jews. I have learned that beneath the ragged coat of a pushcart vendor, there may be a heart of gold, and that a poor seller of collar buttons or suspenders may be a student of the Talmud with a mind that is a gift of the gods. Leaving the seething, modern, fashionable life of Upper Broadway to enter the religious atmosphere of the numerous schools of Jewish literature on the East Side entails a violent contrast in conditions. To see the deeply furrowed, time-scarred faces of the grand old men poring over their beloved Talmud is to get a glimpse of another world, a world of resignation, peace, and love. Within earshot of the thundering traffic of Broadway, I stood gazing at the bowed figures engaged in study and prayer. As I gazed, the sordid walls of the poverty-stricken room faded from my sight, and in their stead I saw, in my mind's eye, the wailing wall of Jerusalem or some ruin of the holy city, a more fitting background to the rabbinical figures so strangely out of place in hustling America. The great passion for the dead and gone past, reflected in the Rembrandt-esque faces of the aged students, lends to their lives a religious grandeur which the uptown tourist, hastily passing on a rubberneck wagon, would never suspect. Behind many a shabby-looking little store, or maybe above some corner saloon, are the societies for the study of Hebrew literature, where congregate the types of Jewish scholars and philosophers that make the heart of the writer and the artist glad. Gray-haired, bewhiskered, sad old men, many of whom have tasted only the bitterness of life, yet such is their faith in the Almighty that they cling to the praying shawl and Bible to blot out the memory of a Kishinev. Their lives of study and prayer amid abject poverty, giving the lie to the fallacy that the Jew lives but for money. I have often wandered among these scholars, picking up the crumbs of wisdom which fall down from the lips of the old men, grateful that my Jewish face and blood gave me the privilege to sit and sketch among them. Somehow or other, my ramblings on the East Side are like the calm after the storm of the uptown struggle. Many times I have felt the heart tug, the longing to be among my people, the real Jews, and leaving theatrical uptown, the land of make-believe and unrest, I have sought the little schools of study where the wonderful, real old men who live by optimism and nourish their souls by faith teach me the lesson of patience and the love of humanity. There is something restful and inspiring when an old man, long past the biblical 70, places his hand on your shoulder and murmurs in Yiddish, "It is God's will." I have envied the profound peace of many of these aged students living in the past and undisturbed by thoughts of the future. Their Jewish view of life is as beautiful as it is simple. It disregards neither heaven nor earth. It looks to earth and observes the evil prevailing among men. It thinks of heaven and ponders on the bliss of the future state. and it urges man to strive to bring heaven on earth, to establish by justice and equity those blessed conditions on earth which so many associate with heaven. Their Jewish view of death is equally beautiful. For those who die, they feel no sorrow. Having once torn aside the veil which parts the known and the unknown, having once entered into the shadow, or rather the sunshine, of the beyond, they are better off in the other life. Whether death means eternal sleep or eternal life, those who have left our side, having passed into the arms of pitiless death, repose in a condition which should give survivors no cause for anxiety on account of their beloved dead. In the pathetic chapter of The Old Curiosity Shop, in which Dickens tells of the death of Little Nell, he makes the schoolmaster utter these words of wisdom, on which all who mourn for their dead may well ponder. "If," he said, "one deliberate wish expressed in solemn terms above the bed could call her back to life, which of us would utter it?" Dickens took this view of death from the Talmud. The interpretation of a difficult passage from the Talmud, or the coining of an epigram, is as food and wine to the wise old students, and there is not an ill in their lives that cannot be soothed, or a blessing that cannot be acknowledged in a quotation from their beloved book. To watch them at their study and devotions, undisturbed by the turmoil about them, is to marvel at the faith which has enabled some of them to live more than 100 years with no other interest in life than their God and their books. From the dingy windows of the schools, the mass of sordid buildings looks to their eyes like the hills of Palestine, and the shriek of the passing elevated trains, and the clanging of the car bells, and the din of passing traffic disturb them not, for they live in the past. The alleged Jew of the fashionable uptown lobster palaces, the blatant, pushing type who is the direct cause of much anti-Semitic feeling, knows and cares nothing for the submerged student of his race. The latter is equally oblivious of the alleged Jew who is contemptuously referred to as a meshamad or apostate. But while the former stands out in the world of money and worldly success as a target for much abuse and hatred, the latter lives with books, unknown and unheeded, drawing from the Talmud a joy that riches cannot buy, and solacing himself with the love of humanity. In strong contrast to their fathers and grandfathers are the children of these old men. Modern America, with its opportunities for all, has torn them from the religious atmosphere and sent them uptown to become lawyers, the artists, and the actors. The Jewish comedian of the vaudeville theater, who nightly sets the audience shrieking at his Yiddish idioms, is in 9 cases out of 10 the son of a scholar, and though the glamour of Broadway success claims him and he no longer lives home, in his heart of hearts he is a Jew and never forgets the old people. He will tell many stories of his parents to his Gentile friends, imitating and exaggerating their many characteristics, but he is mighty sore when he hears a Gentile do the same thing. But, after all, the comic Jew of the modern stage is but an imaginary sketch. There is absolutely nothing humorous in these old men of Judea. Even in the sordid surroundings where you find them engaged in prayer or study, their attitude is one of quiet dignity, a dignity enhanced by their extreme old age. In a little dark den behind a poultry store, I was sketching some of the old men at study. One old fellow, 104 years old, was explaining to a young fellow of 60 a passage in the Talmud about the latter which was in doubt. One fellow, 104 years old, was explaining to a young fellow of 60 a passage in the Talmud about which the latter was in doubt. Both men were without coats. The younger man had left his pushing cart at the door, entirely forgetting the perishable goods thereon, and quite oblivious to the fact that, Hundreds of dirty children were surrounding his cart and fooling with his wares. Other old men were in the school, and the background to their somber faces was the shop with its ghastly poultry suspended by the necks. One of the old Talmudic students would now and again leave his ponderous Bible to serve in the shop, returning after wrapping a fowl in a newspaper to the verses he had been propounding. There was absolutely nothing humorous in all this, but I would love to have had some of my non-Jewish friends see how little thought of money and business the real Jew has. Sometimes when I have felt full of shame at the behavior in public places of men and women with Jewish faces but with no Judaism in their hearts, I have wished that the simple, studious lives of the old men of the East Side could be the standard by which our race is judged, and that the Talmudic saying so aptly put into verse by Rabbi Myers was better known. Which is the path, both right and wise, that for himself a man should find? That which himself much dignifies, and brings him honor from mankind. That is the end of the first article of this week's episode. This was published May 7th, 1921, in the Dearborn Independent. So this was a lengthy story, a lengthy article from someone else. This was not, of course, Henry or one of his editors writing this. But it does give a contrast that there are some, I suppose, sects of Judaism, like Orthodox, for instance, that are real into studying the books, studying Talmud and Bible studies, this sort of thing, and they're not exactly focused on worldly riches like a Rothschild, for instance. So that was Bert Levy. Bert Levy. For the Good of the Race was the title of that. Somewhat interesting. There's always a few kind of renegade standout Jewish people throughout history. Bobby Fischer certainly comes to mind. Maybe Benjamin Friedman, or Jack Bernstein. Some people are at odds, and we sometimes forget that the Jews aren't totally monolithic. Anyways, we're going to move on to the second half of today's episode. This next article is entitled Candid Address to Jews on the Jewish Problem. And before we start the article, we have an excerpt from Jesse H. Holmes from the American Hebrew publication, quote, "It can hardly be an accident that antagonism directed against the Jews is to be found pretty much everywhere in the world where Jews and non-Jews are associated. And as the Jews are the common element of the situation, it would seem probable, on the face of it, that the cause will be found in them rather than in the widely varying groups which feel this antagonism." End quote. This is a candid address to the Jews of the United States. Without subterfuge, without flattery, wholly without fear of all that they may threaten or can do, this attempt is made to set before them the Jewish question as their question, theirs to acknowledge, theirs to consider, and theirs to solve. It's not a question of the Dearborn Independent at all. This paper has merely become the vehicle of unwelcome facts which have finally thrust themselves up for final disposal in this country. Damning this paper, compelling cheap city politicians to interfere with its sale, indulging in ribald humor concerning it, will not affect the facts at all. What the Dearborn Independent says is true, or it is untrue. If true, it ought to be considered. If untrue, it ought to be disproved. The present policy of Jewish leaders is to do neither, but to indulge in antics which go a long way toward illustrating what this paper has said. What the Dearborn Independent says is true, and tens of thousands of Jews know it is true. No representative Jew has ever approached us with a denial of the truth of what has been stated in this paper. Neither has any unrepresentative Jew. The chief objection made against the publication of the facts is always stated in this form. What you say is true. Certain Jews are guilty of the things you charge. But why do you say Jew? Why do you not say Al Wood, Morris Guest, Louis Marshall, Samuel Untermeyer, Edward Lauterbach, Felix Warburg? Why not let it go with these men's names? Why say this word Jew? When you say Jew, it sounds as if you blamed all the Jews. This objection has been seriously and courteously made by a number of Jews who have conferred with the Dearborn Independent on this series of articles, and has been as seriously and courteously considered. What is the answer? First, that these men are Jews. Second, that being Jews, these men constitute a problem for the Jews themselves. Third, it is time for someone to call attention to the necessity of cleaning up on that problem. There has been too much mincing of words. There's been too much concealment of names and relationship. The method which the Jews were taking in this country with regard to concealment was heading them swiftly toward the same conditions which have menaced their race in Europe, and the Dearborn Independent would count no labor lost that would rouse the Jews to a sense of responsibility which rests on them to solve the Jewish question in this country, possibly the only country where it can be solved. Let us be frank. If this paper had mentioned only the names of individual Jews, never mentioning their race, and had exposed them as isolated persons, it would have made no difference in the general Jewish reaction. The cry would have still been that the Jews are being attacked. Whereas the other people of the country would have been just as much in the dark regarding the close bonds which unite all the groups of evil influences in this country. The purpose of this series of articles is to let in the light, to show the Jews generally that the stench has become too great, and to show the rest of the people where the stench arose. The list of charges for the Jews of the United States to consider as affecting the distinguished members of their race is very serious, and the charges are true. It is true that there is a distinct Jewish idea in business and professional life which has eaten away the traditional principles of honor on which Anglo-Saxon life was erected. Every Jew knows that. Every non-Jew knows it. Here and there, a Jew in business or in professional life makes a breakaway from trickery, deception, dishonesty, and exploitation of the gullible public and achieves success with honor. But that Jew also knows that the majority of his brethren in the same line practiced different methods. It is true that behind the amazing degeneracy of the modern stage and motion picture is a solid wall of Jewish ownership and control. This ownership and control must bear the responsibility for the rapid and dangerous deterioration which has since come from such ownership and control which they achieved. It is true that behind all the shoddy and make-believe and adulteration in the staples of life is the Jewish idea of profits, making the ephah small and the shekel great, as they say, and that the initiators of American business into these shady practices were Jewish. It is idle to retort that apt pupils have been found among non-Jews. The point is that before Jewish influence began to be felt in American business, sound quality and a fair price were the rule. It is the Jews' ceaseless boast that wherever they go, they change business, but not for the better. It is true that beneath all the network of trivializing influences in literature, art, politics, economics, fashion, and sport, is Jewish influence controlled by Jewish groups. Their Orientalism has served as a subtle poison to dry up the sound serum of Anglo-Saxon morality on which this country has thrived in its formative years. Is it necessary to specify? In every movement toward a lower standard, a looser relationship, especially toward the overthrow of the old Christian safeguards, do not Jewish names predominate? These charges, and many more, have all been made in detail with evidence submitted and need not be repeated here. The present purpose is simply to get the problem squarely before the Jews of the United States. These charges are true. They cannot be disproved. Jewish leaders have not attempted to disprove them. Thousands of Jews have said that they are true. So where is the obstacle to a settlement? This question is best answered by three typical replies made by Jews during the course of the present series. Number one, they say, "What you say is true, but you should not say it." There is a principle, seldom expressed among the Jews, but always acted on, that Jews should not have public attention called to them except by themselves or their chosen spokesmen. This is unfortunate because any establishment of the Jews as an accepted and trusted part of the general citizenry must include their being known as such. In this country, the Jew should not only welcome the widest knowledge, unless he has something he fears to have known, but should himself undertake the exposure of those things which will eventually bring a shadow on the name of his race. The Jew has never done this. When exposure could no longer be suppressed, the Jewish attitude has always been one of defense, regardless of the merits of the case. "The Jew can do no wrong" is the principle acted upon. Never must a Gentile charge be admitted, however true it may be. Never must a Gentile reform be assisted, no matter how much needed. Now, that principle may do for other countries, but not for the United States. If the Jew is wise, he ought speedily to take warning that in this country the old line of action will not succeed. If Jews continue to show a disposition to defend the malefactors of their race against the just expostulations of the rest of the people, they must not be surprised if the public begins to view them as all one crowd, an inner nation set against the outer nation. Here's the second typical reply. "What you say is true, but your conclusion is wrong. It is not for the Jew to change to your standards. It is for you to change to the Jew's standards." This is the fighting view. It admits that there are two ideas in conflict in the United States, what it unfairly terms the Puritanic idea, as opposed to what it calls the Jewish universal idea. This view would command respect if it represented a superior morality in conflict with a lesser morality, if it represented a higher civilization against a lower civilization. Will any Jew contend that it does? Will any Jew deny that the influence of the Jewish idea in this generation is to break down such morality as we had? Will any Jew deny that the civilization of the United States before the advent of the Jews thither was superior to the highest civilization ever achieved by the Jews anywhere at any period of their history? There are two ideas in conflict, that is certain. The Jewish idea has a tremendous infiltrating force and a serious degenerative power. It is a powerfully disintegrating influence. It eats the substance out of the civilization which it attacks. It destroys its moral virility, throws down its reverence, saps its respect for authority, and casts a shadow on every basic principle. That is the way the Jewish idea works in American civilization. Moral gravitation being, like physical gravitation, downward. It is not difficult to seduce human nature to lower levels, but it is a massive task to lift it higher, to higher levels of morality and reverence and sober justice. And this latter task, organized Jewish effort, has never attempted. The campaign in the United States is a campaign for the breakdown of the ideas that now obtain, not a lifting of them to a higher degree of nobility. If it were an attempt to substitute the austerity of the Mosaic Law, the law given to Moses, not the ordinances decreed by Moses, for the half-hearted Christian idealism of the day, even that would be a task in which all right-hearted men could join. But Moses condemns the modern Jews more severely than anyone else could. They have rejected the Mosaic Law. They have built their international power upon the exact opposite of the Mosaic Law. Moses was given a law of human society which would have saved civilization its greatest tragedies. Moses has a social program, obedience to which for one day would completely wreck the international Jewish power. Moses is their judge, and when the law is established, Moses will be their destroyer. Let the Jews think seriously what is this idea which they set up to follow. Let them penetrate the mists and seek out where this idea had originated. Let them think forward and visualize the effect if this idea should become regnant. It will not become regnant here. There are safeguards here which the true Israelite will understand. But it is as certain as day that the idea will, in the end, destroy, utterly destroy, all who trust in it. This much is gained, however, from the attitude we are now discussing. We have gained clarity of understanding as to just what it is that is in collision. It is two ideas. One of them is the idea of disruption, fostered by the false and delusive hope that disruption will spare the disruptor. And now for the third typical standard reply from most Jews. What you say is true, and we Jews could change it if only we would. The trouble is, we don't want to seem to be driven to it, but I don't see how otherwise we are to do it. Many Jews will recognize this sentiment as their own, but they will be readier to express it to a non-Jew than to a Jew. Why? Because prophets must be prepared to suffer in Judah. Well, if you insist on playing Christ, you must expect to be crucified, said Lilienthal to Isaac Wise. O Jerusalem, that stonest them that are sent to thee. Yet there is need of prophets in Judah today, men who will rise among the people and tell them plainly. The rabbinate is utterly bankrupt of the prophetic spirit. It has fallen into the blindness of the old priesthood. Here and there a literary man attempts to speak, but Jewish art has so accustomed the Jews to make believe that the writing is looked upon as a performance, nothing more. No one with a sense for such things, and there are believers still left in Judah, will doubt that the times are ripe for a great change respecting the Jews. So strong is the feeling among the remnant of believing Jews that it is interpreted as forewarnings of the messianic period. Among the Judaized Christian sects, other interpretations are given to the times, most of which are used to support political Zionism, which represents the materialism and unbelief of present-day Judaism and which will undoubtedly fail as a national, restorative, and as a political program. But however misinterpretive these sectarian and Jewish conclusions may be, they indicate a sense of imminent change. A greater change is indicated than migration to Palestine would be, for that would not mean any change at all in the world, and certainly no change for the better in the fortunes of the Jews. Christians, misguided Christians, one must say, who see God's alleged will of universal Jewish dominion fulfilled by means of the Jews' defiance and despite of the law given to Moses, ought to re-examine their ground for so strange and immoral a conclusion. The breakup of this civilization, this age of civilization, will occur because of the collapse of this system by which the Jew has obtained his hold on the nations. The system that gives him his hold is doomed, is passing, and the fallacy of Jewish tribal destiny to rule the world will pass with it. With this change already on the threshold, prophets should be expected to arise in Judah to recall their people to the law whose previous denial meant their overthrow. These prophets will not be of the Reform school, which denies the God of Israel as a divine person, nor will they be of the ultra-Orthodox school, which makes much of fringes and kookery. They will be of the race of the ancient prophets who spake boldly against Judah's violation of the fundamental law. Our confidence is that a sufficient number of Jews will see the truth and act upon it. What would be the greatest overturn the present Jewish idea, the disruptive Jewish idea, could possibly have? This. a knowledge that the way they are going is the way their own law foredooms to failure, and that the people they hope to triumph over are the people their own scriptures say they are not to triumph over. The first is beyond dispute. There is no success for the Jew, no establishment of him in the world, except upon the basic law given to Moses. In any other attempt, he must fall when the structure collapses. The second is in dispute, but is by no means beyond consideration, especially by Jews. In these matters, the Jews are much wiser than the so-called Christians. There is among the Jews the law of the brother and the law of the stranger. The law of the stranger permits several important things which the law of the brother prohibits. The Jews have been treating the rest of the world, often intentionally, sometimes as a matter of course, according to the law of the stranger. This is one of the influences which has helped to solidify Jewry against the rest of the world. Suppose it should be shown that the people in whose lands the Jews have never been persecuted, the people of those lands which the Jews have never been driven, but to which they have hopefully and joyfully come, are not strangers and are not to be treated as strangers, and, so far from being strangers, are really the leaders and rulers of that ethical stream of influence of which the Jews, but for their disloyalty to their destiny, might have been an important part. Suppose it should be shown that Judah, the driven part of Israel, has been blindly attacking the led part of Israel. Suppose it should be shown that Judah is not the Israel upon whom great destiny is to come, but a small part of that Israel and not even a participating part until it returns. If these things should once take hold of the intensified consciousness of Judah as facts, there would be such a change in human society in general, such a change in the Jewish situation in particular, as would make a return to Palestine a mere summer excursion in comparison. Jews are thinking about those very matters now. They are thinking from within. They are seeking a reason, the thoughtful among them, that is, for the sense of the unfitness which they feel when they adopt the traditional attitude of enmity toward the others in this case being the Anglo-Saxon peoples. The reason for this sense of impropriety is that here, in this land, the Jew will have to change his attitude of antagonism and dwell in peace as in a land prepared for him, not as lord of it, by any means, but as a grateful wanderer at last come home. Not as a ruler, but as adding his bit to the righteousness, prosperity, and peace of the people. It is not a question of religion. Let the Jew get back his Mosaic religion. It is the most perfect social system ever devised and directly contrary to the practical modern Jews' idea of things. It is not a question of intermarriage. Let the Jew keep, as long as he pleases, his idea that he is racially different. The suggestion of intermarriage is a crude one and always indicates a lack of grasp of the Jewish question. Let the Jew keep all his traditions. They are not objectionable in any way. The slightest regard for them can only hold them as romantic. But let him shed his false notion of the Jew against the world. Let him shed his false program of breaking down Christendom by the infiltration of Orientalism into business, art, entertainment, and the professions. Let him abolish the false ideal that it is an honor to Jewry to save a guilty Jew from the common law, and a disgrace to Jewry to see a guilty Jew punished by the common law. Let him draw up notice to all the Jews of the United States who, by hook or crook, are sowing vile seed in society, that the Jewish community charges itself with their misbehavior and will use methods well known to Jews to bring that misbehavior to an end. Let the Jew end forever the disgrace of an anti-defamation committee which grows frantic over innocent remarks on the part of Gentiles and is absolutely indifferent to the misdeeds of thousands of Jews who do more damage to the Jewish name than all the Gentile critics and newspapers could do in 20 years. No one can give the Jews a bad reputation but the Jews themselves. Most Jews who have given this matter a thought will agree. A good deal of bad temper exists among them, no doubt, and it will be hard for them to admit that anything the Dearborn Independent may contend for is right, but the idea here expressed, when divorced from this paper, does command respect from many Jews. The question remains, when will they start on the program here suggested? Human nature being what it is, they will hate to start at all if it will seem that the present agitation has compelled them. But would they have started without the agitation? Is it possible for an additional number of Jews to catch the thought that this series of articles cannot be so easily explained away? We are not referring to the contents now, but to the fact that these articles exist at all, as being the creation of prejudice or hatred or vindictiveness or ignorance. Suppose these articles should be truly a sign of the times for American Jewry. Suppose they offer a warning word, however unwelcome, and a light, however undesired, which it would be most unwise for Jews to ignore. Suppose these articles were conceived in a spirit far different than the average pro-Jewish spouter is competent to understand. Suppose the ultimate benefit will be mostly Judah's, i.e. the Jews. Suppose the set time has now come for the Jews to quit their attitude of attacking everyone who shows them the truth, and to profit by this report of the poor figure they cut in American life today. Suppose these people who are moved to search and report the truth about what the Jews are truly the shofar calling the people to a new day. Is it wise to let stubbornness counsel? Is it wise to let pride close the ear? The enemies of the Jews are those who defend them for the pay of hire or praise or votes. The enemies of the Jews are those who bespeak them fair to their faces and express quite different thoughts behind their backs. The writer of this personally knows that two of the principal Gentile defenders of the Jews, men who have shouted and ranted through the press on the Jews' behalf, are men who privately hold and express thoughts about the Jews which are sheer hatred and enmity and fear. Mostly fear. The enemies of the Jews are those who encourage them to take an attitude that they cannot hold in America. Not as affecting their personal liberty at all, but their social attitude and the public right. These are the enemies of the Jews, and yet these are the ones whom Judah counts his friends. Just a note here, the editors are using Judah to refer to the Jews, which anyone paying attention is probably not true. You know the Christian identity truth that the tribe of Judah and Jews today are probably two separate things. But anyways, continuing on. These are the enemies of the Jews, and yet these are the ones whom Judah counts his friends. They are hired friends, false friends, incapable of realizing for a moment that this whole question, or what this whole question means. Judah's friends today are those who will speak the surgical truth to him, braving his fury in the knowledge that the future will justify the word. Judah's leaders have betrayed him in this country. They do not know that they have crossed the Jordan. The Jews are as sheep without shepherds in this land, and the chief objection which the Jewish leaders have to the Dearborn Independent is that the Jews may read it and learn how shepherdless they are. The Jewish leaders' opposition to the Dearborn Independent rises mostly from the fear that the Jews may read it. The Jews have read it, and they have not found hatred. They have not found abuse and calumny. They have not found ignorance and malice. They have found statements of fact calmly set forth, not to arouse hatred among the non-Jews, but to arouse a sense of social responsibility among the Jews. These are significant times. The emergence of the Jewish question is a part of the culmination of destiny that has come upon us, nor for harm, but for good. The Jews must uncover their eyes and unstop their ears, and they will see the beginning of the end of their travail, and they will hear that to which they have been too long heedless. The justification of a discussion of the Jewish question is the good for the Jews, and the greatest present obstacle to that good is the Jews themselves. The time is here when they shall see it. Okay, that's the end of the second half of today's episode. This was published January 7th, 1922. So we have in the first half of the episode the publication or the article or excerpt that was written by Bert Levy about For the Good of the Race and how Jews, how he was astonished to find that Jews in America are not textbook kind of scholarly religious Jews, but instead the money hustler, loan shark type. And then for the second half, we had a nice summation of what was happening at the time, and it's actually probably a really good way to wrap up this series, although we do have just one part left for next week. But pointing out what's going on here with the Dearborn Independent and what was happening at the time is important to understand, and it this series, I think you guys, if you've listened to the whole thing, it doesn't take to hysterics, it doesn't take to malice or slander or get into the any of the lowbrow sort of attacks on Jews or Judaism. It brings pretty solid grievances against them, their power, their control, their influence against the host countries throughout history. I think they were more than fair, and in fact, in some spots, I think Henry and the editors were... Maybe they didn't know at the time, because this was 100 years ago that these things were written. So we got 100 more years of history to see how the Jews act and what they do and how dastardly are their deeds. But I think he was a little too soft on them in some spots and gave them the benefit of the doubt in some spots. But regardless, this was a good way to sort of conclude the series. We will have one more part for next week. Like I said, yeah, it is just one more part, 5 or 6 more pages. I think probably a lot of people would underplay what Henry and the editors are saying here, and I think it is good to pointed out that I think there is something to it. I think Jews need to be made aware of these sort of things and that there is a problem and that they ought tread carefully or tread lightly, because if there ever is some sort of backlash, guess who's going to feel it first? Do you think the Rothschilds are going to feel it first? Or do you think the local Jew in a Gentile community is going to feel it first when there's a backlash? The little Jews will feel it first and they have the most to lose. And the big Jews never really get touched. They'll grab their assets and make off for a foreign country and get out of harm's way before things really get bad. But the little Jew really can't, or doesn't even see it coming in some cases. So there is something to it, and I think if you got in private with some Jewish people, they know this. They know that the Jews have a disproportionate amount of influence, power, and control to crush anyone who comes up against them and even says something against them publicly in the press. They know this. Do they know about the Rothschild agenda and how deep the rabbit hole goes? No, they probably don't. But they do know, and I'm sure they do boast amongst themselves in social settings and in private about how much power and control their tribe has. And I guess it's all fun and games until the bill comes due, right? And it has happened throughout history, 109 times since the time of Christ, that they've been kicked out of countries, banned from countries, and had their money and their riches stripped from them in the process. I don't know if there ever will be a mass one or if there ever will be one here in the United States. It's looking doubtful, but it is good to know, and I would encourage you to, if you know some in real life or colleagues or something, I mean, don't bring it up in a work setting where you're going to get yourself fired for going over the top and looking like a crazy anti-Semite, but I don't know. If you got good relationships with some of them, throw it out there and just feel them out on it. And I think if you do it in the right way, you do it in a disarming fashion, and you can get them to be honest, I think they'll readily admit to it. And they see it as, oh, we're so successful because we're so smart. They don't really see the crimes that and how much deception has been used to quiet other people and hush other people. And they likely do not know the truth about the world wars or the banking stuff, anything like that. I don't know. I suppose it's akin to blacks feeling like they're athletically superior to American whites because look at how disproportionately black the NFL and the NBA and the sports league, college athletics. I think it's on that level of pride. But the little Jew is probably just as stupid as most goyim out there, I'd be willing to say. And it just, they have an excellent ethnic network. They're excellent at networking and making connections, and coming from a Jewish background, I think, opens up a lot of doors that you and I just miss out on, right? It's almost like a ethnic secret society of sorts. There's a certain amount of trust that if you get your foot in that door with them, and you can pass yourself off as one of them, or they trust you, I think there's a whole set of doors that can open up to you economically, career-wise, financially, prestige, influence. I think it's like a big extended family. And I'm sure most of the listeners would probably think, well, you have this sort of ethnic nepotism. I don't think it's the worst thing. I know a lot of listeners out there would probably want to do the same thing for their own group, white Christians. And certainly I would agree. I don't think there's anything wrong or evil in that, but I'm just saying how it is. And I think I've had these experiences myself with roommates going to school or people I went to school with that happen to be Jewish. And, they're very sensitive about people in conspiracy history, because they know it's going to lead to it, to the dark place that they don't want the Gentiles to read about. And it's good if you blame Islam or blame anyone else, but just don't blame the Jews. I had that experience one time. And I had another one where pretty much I mentioned Jewish power and how it needed to be stopped, and I would love to see it stopped. And the other person just scoffed at me. It scoffed in my face like that would never happen. He just thought it was hilarious. Right? So, I don't know. You know how personal experience sometimes speaks to you or breaks through and really sinks in a lot more than reading something in a book. I think that's how most people are. And I've had a few of those kind of instances in life, but not too many of them. Nothing earth-shattering, but anyways, something to note and keep in mind if you have the ability to do so, talk with them about it. It's interesting, but okay, I've gone too far on that tangent. I want to say this is part 41. Like I said, we've got one more left. This series has taken a lot of time. It's taken a lot of time to edit and produce them, and Sven and others at Radio Aryan putting them up on YouTube. They put a lot of time and effort and really helped me out a lot in finishing it. So thank you to them. And thank you guys for listening. If you wish, take this, compile it, and spread it around. Put it up on YouTube. Put it on a flash drive and give it to someone. Listen to it on the way to and from work. By all means, take it and spread it. And I hope it gets consumed. I didn't do this for my own satisfaction necessarily or for my own health. I did it so that it would be on record and other people could enjoy it. Anyways, until next week, guys, take care. God bless. Praise Christ. Bye-bye.
to Radio